Mesdames, Messieurs, bonsoir. Au nom de Mme Bissonnette, mais avec son autre casquette de présidente et directrice générale de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec, je suis heureux de vous accueillir à la Grande Bibliothèque pour ce cycle de conférences avec l'Institut Thomas More. Et c'est l'occasion, je suis Justin Roussel, secrétaire général et directeur des affaires juridiques de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec. Et c'est intéressant pour nous, lorsque nous avons des nouveaux cycles de conférences, de souligner les partenariats que nous avons et que nous intensifions avec plusieurs organismes pour créer des cycles de conférences dans différents domaines, ici notamment à l'auditorium de la Grande Bibliothèque, et nous nous réjouissons énormément de ce partenariat dont M. Cullen a eu l'initiative, et remercier Pascal Ryan, qui est votre agent de liaison au niveau de ce partenariat, qui est ici présente, mais quand on a le spot comme ça, on ne voit absolument rien.
Mais on pourrait peut-être monter l'éclairage.
Peut-être. Bon, on aura d'autres travaux en perspective. Alors, bon, je viens d'hériter d'un autre job. Je suis heureux de présenter cette troisième activité d'une série de quatre entrevues intitulée « The Culture of Our Cities, Conversation on Today's Urban Experience », au cours desquelles des invités de marque partagent avec le public leur point de vue sur la complexité grandissante de nos villes en expansion. Alors, l'invitée de ce soir a-t-elle besoin d'être présentée? Lise Bissonnette, je ne remonterai pas à vos origines, Madame Bissonnette. Elle est abitibienne, donc il faut toujours le dire. C'est très important pour elle. Et elle a toujours à cœur la promotion et la mise en valeur des régions, avant tout. Et donc, elle a eu une brève carrière en enseignement, puisque nous sommes au niveau d'une noble institution universitaire. Et elle était journaliste, courriériste parlementaire, éditorialiste, directeur du journal Le Devoir. Elle était, on la voit aujourd'hui comme présidente directrice générale de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales, mais elle était une ardente promotrice et défenseur du projet de la Grande Bibliothèque, et elle en fut dès l'origine la première présidente directrice générale en fin août 1998. Voilà, donc, et en plus, c'est ma patronne, je me dois d'être gentil. Elle sera interviewée par Mme Edwidge Asselin et M. Jim Cullen de l'Institut Thomas More. Et à la fin, j'aimerais aussi vous rappeler que la prochaine activité de l'Institut est le 29 mai avec Mme Julia Gersovitz, qui sera l'invitée de l'Institut pour s'entretenir de Culture of Our Cities dans la série. Alors, M. Cullen, Mme Asselin, je vous remets la parole et soyez gentils, s'il vous plaît. Bonne soirée.
How could we do otherwise?
Thank you. Moira is going to say a few words.
I'm sorry?
Moira.
Good evening. And welcome to this third evening of the Thomas More Institute interview series, continuing on this year's theme, The Culture of Our Cities, Conversations on Today's Urban Experience. My name is Moira Carley. I'm both a student and a leader at the Thomas More Institute, and I'm pleased to tell you that my association with the Institute has been long and fruitful. This year, our series has been dedicated to Ben Scher, who died this past year. Ben and Olga Scher have been companions of the Thomas More Institute for many years. When Julian Scher, Ben and Olga's son, was interviewed a few weeks ago, he mentioned that late in life, when Ben found himself in a wheelchair with limited mobility, he learned to use the internet to explore his questions and share his learning. And I'm one of the lucky ones graced by Ben's generosity and friendship. Last year, this is an example, he was reading Ian McEwan's novel, Saturday, and he knew that I had also read it. His curiosity led him to research the origin of the quote at the beginning of the novel, and which was taken from Saul Bellow's Herzog. I received in the mail from Florida a whole chapter from Herzog with the original paragraph underlined for my benefit. Wherever his great spirit has gone, Ben Scher continues to gift us all tonight with these words from Saul Bellow, who describes Herzog wondering, quote, what it means to be a man in a city, in a century, in transition, in a mass transformed by science, under organized power, subject to tremendous controls, in a condition caused by mechanization. After the late failure of radical hopes, in a society that was no community and devalued the person, the beautiful super machinery opening a new life for innumerable mankind, would you deny them the right to exist? You, yourself, are a child of this mass and a brother to all the rest. That's the end of the quote from Herzog. Our guest this evening, Lise Bissonnette, needs little introduction in this beautiful space because she's also our gracious host. As President and Chief Executive Officer of the Bibliothèque et Archives Nationales du Québec, after her post-secondary studies in education in Montreal, Strasbourg, and Paris, Lise Bissonnette started her career in journalism in 1974 at Le Devoir, a career that would take her to the direction of that organization in 1990. She's received many distinctions, 5 honorary degrees from various universities, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Académie des Lettres du Québec. She was accepted at the Pantheon of Canadian Journalism, holds Lord de la Pléiade, is Officer of the Lord National du Québec, and is a member of the La Légion d'honneur de France. She's the author of 5 books and 2 collections of essays. Some of her fictional works have been translated into English by the House of Anansi Press. Her latest book, Fleuve ou le Parfum de Balzac, was published in 2006 by Édition Hurtubise. Madame Bissonnette will be interviewed by Hedwige Asselin, who taught philosophy and history of art at various colleges and universities in Quebec. She holds a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Montreal in La Grammatologie de l'Art. Well known to many of us as an art critic, Hedwige Asselin has written for Le Devoir, as well as for art reviews and art catalogs. She served on many juries for art exhibits, notably Symposium de la Jeune Peinture de Baie-Saint-Paul and L'Exposition Les Fumeuses. She's often heads conferences on the history of art at the Maison de la Culture and museums throughout Quebec. Currently, Hedwige Asselin is president of the Administrative Council for the Galerie Observatoire and on the team of administrators for the Centre d'Exposition des Gouverneurs de Sorel. Jim Cullen has been actively engaged in education as a teacher and administrator for most of his adult life. He holds a Master of Arts degree from Concordia University in the history and philosophy of religion. Until his retirement in 2006, Jim Cullen worked for the Quebec Ministry of Education as assistant to the Assistant Deputy Minister for Services to the English-speaking community. He's a member of the board of the Quebec Program Evaluation Society, and he is the Quebec delegate to the Canadian Evaluation Society. Currently, Jim is the president of the Thomas More Institute. Just a word about our strategy for the evening. First of all, congratulations to all of you who made it here. The first hour, we'll have the formal interview, and then after about an hour on the clock, we'll have a small break, and then the floor will be open and there'll be microphones available for you to ask questions. So enjoy the evening.
Good evening. Already in 1996 in Le Devoir, in February, you wrote about La Grande Bibliothèque. Yes. And at that time, could you imagine that eventually you would be in charge of it?
Certainly not. absolutely not. I remember that column, it wasn't an editorial. Very often people write about this event. The fact that I wrote about the Grande Bibliothèque and the fact that I wrote about the Grande Bibliothèque in Le Devoir, it wasn't an editorial. I used to write a lot of editorials, but I used to write also a column on Saturdays, and this was a column that I devoted to. There it is, you should answer. And maybe we should have said before, you know, don't forget. I used to write this column. It was sort of my personal column. Despite what it seems, I didn't like to write editorials. I found them moralizing. I found it went with the job, but I didn't like it. And so I kept this column for the pleasure of writing about the arts, culture, you know, things that were really interesting, apart from politics. That was, I remember quite well, because I was forever looking for a topic. For something to say in that column, you know, you obsess when you are a columnist, you obsess about topics all the time. And as I was discussing with my companion about that, he said, why don't you suggest a Grande Bibliothèque? Because this was, you know, in France, they were building the Grande Bibliothèque de France. And so I wrote this thing, tongue-in-cheek in a way, and I said, Mr. Bouchard was Premier of Quebec at the time, and I said, you people from the Parti Québécois, you talk about culture all the time, but you didn't do much. And so if you want my advice on something that you could do, you know, just to leave something behind, because most of the large institutions had been created by the liberal governments, and so I just said something like, and if you read this column, it's very superficial. I mean, but I was having fun, so that was my first column on this subject. But not very long after, Mr. Bouchard, who had seen the Vancouver Public Library, and of course he was very influenced also by what was going on in France. Understood that it would be a good project, and with Louise Baudouin, they decided to launch a committee to look into that project. And I wrote all the time. I was never satisfied with whatever they decided. I was criticizing the committee for this and that, but nevertheless very interested in this. So I wrote quite a few editorials and columns again about that, but never did I imagine that this would come my way, no.
And how did it happen?
Oh, it simply happened. Well, you know, this is very personal. I'm not going to give you my age, but, I don't have much of gray hair, but nevertheless, I'm not that young. And I had decided, it has to do with journalism. I had a very interesting, nice career, but I always told myself that I wouldn't age as a journalist. That at the beginning of my 50s, I would look for something else. Not look, but if something would come my way, I would look at it. Because that's a very personal view of journalism that I have there. I think that especially when you're a commentator, when you're a pundit, as they say, and if you write about politics all the time, and, you know, I'd done my part. And I was deadly afraid of the idea of repeating myself all the time. And that's what most commentators do after some time. If you read columns or editorials, you'll notice that people, when they have been there for a long, long time, they're forever telling you, well, during the time of Mitch Lake and during the time of this and that, and that reminds me when Diefenbaker was doing this and that. And they have that in their mind. I mean, they're an encyclopedia, and they keep analyzing the present with something from the past. And that's so clear when you begin to read with that in mind, you will just notice what I'm telling you, and read newspapers, and you'll see that it's after some time it's sort of a, so you've said what you have to say, and then you keep coming back at it all the time. So I was very afraid of that. So I thought you have something interesting. And of course, it would have to be in education or culture. And so it came with both, I mean, education and culture. And so Mr. Bouchard called one day. In fact, it was Louise Baudouin. I was in Europe, and she called and asked me if I would meet with the premier. And I asked her why, and she said she didn't say exactly, but I understood. And I had to make up my mind in a couple of days. Because if you're the publisher of Le Devoir and you have to decide if you're going to leave the newspaper to take a job as important as this with the government, because it is a public job in the public service, you have to make up your mind quite rapidly, because you cannot go on and write in a newspaper and be the publisher of a newspaper, especially Le Devoir, if you are entertaining some kind of relationship with the people who are in power. So I left in a week. I just, turned around and left Le Devoir, and I accepted with great enthusiasm, I must say. This was exactly what I was expecting, the kind of calling that I felt would be very interesting for me, something new, something different. But still, basically, it was because it's a work of culture and it's a work of education. And as you've been told, I did all my studies in education, and my favorite topic was education and culture, not politics, though I did write a lot about politics.
When you had the opportunity, I guess the challenge was where to place the library. I guess that was quite a debate.
That was a debate before I left. Before I left Le Devoir, it's because it happened when the committee was planning the Grand Bibliothèque. In its final report, I can't remember if it was the final, but anyway, in the one of their reports. They had studied, I think, five sites in Montreal where the Grand Bibliothèque should be, and they had opted for the Place des Arts, the Îlot Balmoral. And I was mad. Because I had followed the project from the very beginning. I had observed and I had written about the reports, and I felt that something was wrong with that, and I knew that this place where we are, the square, which is Maisonneuve, Ontario, and you remember that it was the Palais du Commerce that was sitting right here where we are, and the Palais du Commerce was almost empty, except for the Taj Mahal. Do you remember the Taj Mahal? I do. And that was the first urban discussion that we had about this place was the Taj Mahal. There was a Taj Mahal, and there was a bookstore, and a used bookstore. And so for the rest, it was all empty, and it was destined to sort of be demolished one day. So I began to argue in Le Devoir that it should be here in the Palais du Commerce. And it sort of caught fire, this opinion that it should be here. And I should say thank you to the people around this place, mm-hmm. mostly cultural organizations. I think of l'Académie des Lettres, La Maison des Écrivains, others in the vicinity who wrote, op-ed pieces everywhere, and began that debate. And so Madame Baudouin decided that she would hold a public hearing about where should the bibliothèque be. And I think it's 75% of the people who went to these hearings and who said something about it or presented a memoir said that, that they favored this place. I think there was only one in favor of L'Îlot Balmoral. So so the thing was decided by public hearings, and I'll be forever grateful for the people who really cared to come and discuss this. And I remember a commentator in Toronto saying, he went to these hearings and he said, you know, they were all discussing about the building and not about the bibliothèque. Well, the building is the bibliothèque, and what was discussed there, though it seemed that they were only discussing the place where the bibliothèque should sit, in fact, they were discussing the concept of this of the Grande Bibliothèque. Where should it be was very important. I remember friends, columnists who disagreed with me entirely in that, saying that it should be more to the west because that's where people, you know, where you found people who were already reading. Well, you know, and so when come to think about it, we were discussing what was going to be the Grande Bibliothèque at the time. So these hearings were very, very important. Yes. Though they seemed to be just about place, mm-hmm. they were touching really on the basis of the project itself. So it was
last week, Madame Sherry Simon mentioned several world cities and compared Montreal mm-hmm. to world cities. And I understand that this is a unique structure here in the sense of its archives, it's a library, it's open to the public. Mm-hmm. What is unique about this?
Well, you have to make a distinction between the Grande Bibliothèque and the institution. The institution is called Bibliothèque et Archives Nationales du Québec. And it contains we're present in 11 places in Quebec. We have three places in Montreal. The one is the Grande Bibliothèque, which is the sort of large public library, North American public library, plus a national collection from the Bibliothèque Nationale. We have a conservation center in Rosemont, a beautiful building also, by the way. We're the best housed cultural institution in Quebec, by far. And so the conservation center in Rosemont is the part of the work of a Bibliothèque Nationale, of a national library, which is done there. And it's mostly the conservation, the research work, the cataloging, all the sort of intellectual work that goes with the national library is there. But people come and consult the books and the periodicals and the national collection here also. So it's this building is both a large public library and the consultation part of the national library. And we have also the building of the Archives, National Archives, which is on Vigée, one of the most beautiful restoration work that has been done on the building from the beginning of the century in Montreal. It used to be the L'École des Hautes Études Commerciales at the beginning of the 20th century, and it's now the Archives Nationales, a wonderful building also. And so that's what we have three in Montreal. We have the Direction of Archives is in Quebec City. It's another heritage building. It's the former Grand Séminaire du Québec, a Cormier building by the famous architect. And we have also seven offices with archives, centers for archives throughout Quebec. So it's a large institution. What's unique about it is that it's four things. It's a national library, it's the National Archives, it's a large public library, and it's a virtual library. And we're one of the most advanced virtual libraries in the world. That came with the Grande Bibliothèque, given that we had to prepare the structure for the technologies, the IT information technologies in this building, because, you know, today libraries are very high-tech. So we had to prepare for this building. So at the same time, given that this building is paid for by all Quebecers on the whole territory of Quebec, we paid a lot of attention to the services that we were going to give to people throughout the province of Quebec. So you do that through a lot of technologies. And so we invested heavily in the technologies, information technologies. And so today we have one of the best virtual library also. It's not only a virtual library, it's services also that we give to people. So all in all, if you put all this together, no, there's no other place in the world where they have these four functions. Usually large public libraries are metropolitan libraries. They belong to cities. And here, in fact, it's a very special concept because we've taken the staff and the collections of the former central library, and they've become our collections and our staff, and so they've been integrated into this large institution, and most of our operating budget comes from Quebec City. Almost all of it, the City of Montreal contributes a little share of the function, the operating budget of the Grande Bibliothèque.
So. There's another interesting aspect that we find here also is that you organize exhibitions.
Oh yes,
art exhibitions, and that's
you're not surprised, Edwidge.
No, definitely not. Talking to one of the great collectors we have in Quebec.
Well, you know, I'm not a great collector, but I do value visual arts a lot. And but it's not it's exhibitions for that exhibitions that go with the National Library and National Archives. It's a fascinating work that you can do there. There was no other exhibition space in Montreal for the kind of exhibitions that we wanted to show. First, we have different missions, as you just realized, and so we have different kinds of exhibitions, but documentary exhibitions, literary exhibitions, and even we have some art exhibitions, but they have to be related to our missions. For example, we had just before this one, which is on school books right now. It's a wonderful exhibition that we have right now, and it's on almost finished, so you should go. Just prior to that, we had Robert Wolff, a very well-known Quebec artist. Unfortunately, he died a year before the beginning of the exhibition, but we prepared it with him. And Robert Wolff his archives are with us, but basically it's because he was doing engravings and des estampes. And so we, as a national library, we do collect engravings. We have a mission to collect everything that's been published in Quebec in terms of works on paper. And so when we do art exhibitions, it has to be with, you know, works on paper, basically. And so we will have some of them. We can have historical exhibitions. We have some of them at the Vigée. We call that Vigée, but it's the Centre of Archives of Montreal on the Rue Vigée, which is the building is called Gilles Locard. We have a wonderful exhibition space, more to the norms than we have here. We sort of played with, you know, there's some light that shouldn't be there, but we wanted the space to be more inviting, so that's why we sort of cheated a little bit. But at the Centre d'Archives, it's a beautiful exhibition space, and right now we have an exhibition about the books that the Sulpiciens, how do you say in English, the Sulpicians, when they came here, as you know, it's this year, the 350th anniversary of the arrival of the Sulpiciens in the Nouvelle-France, and so we have in our collections books that belong to the Sulpicians. And so one of our librarians and an archivist worked together, and we're now presenting this exhibition about these rare books that these people, what they were reading. It's interesting. Not all of it is religious. And so if you want to see a nice exhibition, it's difficult to exhibit books. Mm-hmm. But this one is...
Maybe I could use this opportunity when you're speaking out of exhibits to speak about Gaston Miron.
Yes, we have.
I have a question that's a little bit long, but I want to link it a little bit to one of your novels, if I might. So François Dubeau, who's one of the characters in the novel, he talks about his childhood. His mother, he grew up on a street called Mentena Street, and there was a man, a little man in a wig one day, and he asked François and his friends, "Do you go to the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts?" Est-ce que vous êtes allé au Musée des Beaux-Arts?
And they said, no. And the little man choked with indignation. That's inconceivable. It's just next door. And then in another story, Marie is encouraged to read Theodore Dreiser. Francois was encouraged to go to the Montreal Museum, and she was encouraged to read Dreiser. These were turning points in their lives for these people. And Gaston Miron, whom I must admit, I met only 2 weeks ago, so it's special in my life that I looked at this exhibit upstairs. But he talks about a tremendous moment in his life. He read a poet who said, tous les pays qui n'ont pas la légende seront condamnés à mourir de foi. Every country that does not have legends and stories are condemned to die of cold. He said that set him off on his poetry for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you, with what conversion question would you like to provoke young people and provoke us?
Conversion question? I'm not sure that I get exactly. I mean, with a question like the one to François Dubois, and oh my God. young people. Well... You mean, you know, have you read the book or have you, where did you go? I would say, can you stay in a room for 3 hours and read one book? It's difficult today. It's all about, you know, people are told to travel all the time as if life was outside of their head and their heart. And they're incited to sit in front of the internet all day and chat. And so I have a tremendous feeling that people, young people, find it very, very difficult more and more to stay alone for some time and think and read. And I might be wrong, but I think it's their challenge today, and they find it difficult. Right here in this library, when we began to think of spaces for teenagers, I got the idea. I saw that in the library in France. You have to, if you want them to come to the library, they have to be like if they sit in a bistro. I mean, they need some noise. They need some element of circulation, so that's why we have these ramps and that's where they like to sit. And it's telling in a way that, you know, this need for noise, you know, doing many things at the same time, all of this, I think they find it really difficult. It's challenging for them to just sit there and not relax, just, you know, work in there, read and think for more than half an hour. So that's one thing I would challenge them to do.
If I could take you back, I actually had a chance in the ministry to fly into Val d'Or and to in the Abitibi region. When you fly into Rouen or Val d'Or, what do you see?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I'm driving there tomorrow morning early because it's the Salon du Livre de l'Abitibi-Témiscamingue that's starting. So I'll be there tomorrow night and I'll drive. I like better driving than because it's my place. Once I get to Mont Laurier, it's finished. I forget all about it. You know, I forget my friends, I forget my work, I forget everything. And I like to drive in the Parc La Vérendrye. But when I land there and I see these spaces, it's very, very important to me. We are what we were, we are made by our childhood, there's no doubt about that, and by the what we saw in our childhood. I always said, you know, I like the sea, I like to see an ocean, but I get tired very rapidly. I just, you know, It's noisy, and it's it's also too big, and it's moving, and you know, and so it's beautiful. But for me, it's not something that that I feel at home with. So I like to see that, but not more than that. But I like rocks and semi tundra, and that's what I like. I don't like big trees. I don't like, you know.
But isn't that the place of Cain?
Yes, and it's tough. And it's, you know, the psychologists today have a word that they like very much. They use too much. It's resilience. I think that we in the ABTB were brought up as resilient people. Our parents were, because they decided to move there well before my parents went there in the 30s. It was already getting better, but those who went there in the 20s and the beginning of the 20th century. It's so tough when you read the memoirs of all these people. It's just unbelievable. And it's a frontier town also. These are frontier towns. If you went to Val d'Or, but if you go to Malartic, that's the place to go. Mm-hmm. It looks like the Far West. We still have these constructions with the facade like the Far West. It's a young place. My companion tells me all the time, you have no roots. He is right. In a way, you know, I'm very nomadic. I've changed homes. I mean, I've moved about 20 times in my life, and it's not enough, and I will move again. And it's so we are people who are forever looking in front of us, except and not the past. But it's a tough place, and though it's getting a bit today, it's getting much easier for people to live there. Yes, it has to do with Cain, and I used it also in one of my books. But I think that you have to redefine beauty. I mean, we are used to think that beauty is a beautiful, you know, it's an ocean, it's a mountain, it's a blue sky, it's and it's green. And beauty can be also in those rocks, in a mine, in the shaft of the mines, and these horrible things that they did to the paysage and the Abitibi. But nevertheless, it's and I like it like that. I like it simple and sometimes cruel. Sometimes cruel. Cruelty is part of our life also, and it's part of the making of what we are and where we live and what the people do to each other. So it's a cruel place also from time to time. The weather is difficult, though it's warmer there today than in Montreal.
Before you move again, could you tell us about La Flouve, this house you live in on Boulevard Gouin?
Well, it is, again, it's one of those decisions that we made in a hurry, just like, you know, but I like that. I think you have to listen to what you want to do. We always bought paintings like this, you know, just on a whim. And so this is a funny thing because all my life I'd said that I wanted to write novels or essays or whatever, not in my home, that I wanted to find a place where I would go and work, I mean, and write. So we were looking for, we had this rather large house in Arensic, and we stayed there for almost 10 years, which is very long. And so we were looking for a place, for a sort of a condo in downtown Montreal that we would convert it to some kind of personal library where I would go when I wanted to write. Okay, so that's where we started. So we began to look at all these condos all over the place in Montreal. There were a lot. There was one just beside it, and that we almost bought. And we never found exactly what we wanted. And one day we were coming back from the Eastern Townships and I was reading the classified in La Presse. And I said, oh, there's an ancestral house here that they sell only for $95,000 in Montreal. So he said, no, this must be $95,000 in Montreal for an ancestral house. You know, this must be some kind of shack. And yeah, well, it was in a way. And the address was there. So we decided that we would go and see it right away on that Sunday afternoon. And there was nobody in that house. There was a sort of an ad that was there, and so we bought it 3 days after. Talk of a condo. This was a house from 1811 that was built in 1811. It says ancestral or heritage, but it has nothing to do. It was built in 1811 by people who were dirt poor, and who the man was just looking for a place. He bought this small land beside the Rivière des Prairies, and he was just looking for a place where he could put his 5 children. They would have 13 in the end, and it was 500 square feet. And yes, in the end, when he died, there were 13 people living in that house. And so we were very lucky in a way because, yes, it had been transformed by some people, but not that much. And I know a lot about heritage houses because I'm a member of an association of owners of these kind of houses. So this was no manor. This was no, you know, residence for the rich. This was no seigneurie. This was just the ordinary people. And it was a miracle that this kind of structure had survived. Because most of them, of course, were. And if I had asked the city of Montreal or l'arrondissement, because there's a distinction here, if I had asked for a demolition permit, I would have had it in 2 hours. But we decided, we just decided that this would be my place to write in Montreal. So it was kind of a chalet in the city, 10 minutes from my house, which was interesting, and a beautiful place, and with great trees and nice environment. And so we sort of kept it for a few months like that, just went there from time to time, just enjoying the place. And finally, we decided that we would restore it, and we would move there, and then we would build something very contemporary with this 19th century little house. And so we called Pierre Thibault, the architect, who's now very well known, was well known at the time, but much better known now. And we called him in Quebec City and asked him if he would have an idea for this place. But the condition was to keep this small house. And it was the funniest thing. I mean, because it almost fell apart. I mean, when we began to work under it, because it was a shack, people. It was a talk of the town. People were coming by and looking at this and said, "Why on earth would they put that kind of money in that kind of house?" Because we really redid the whole thing exactly like it was in 1811. So it's a small part of a big house, but if you walk by, you don't see the large house. It's just at the back, and it's beautiful also. It's a very modern, very contemporary. It's all glass and wood, but at the front, all you see is this beautiful little house. And so I decided that I would write a book about this, and I got interested in the life of these people. It's very difficult. It was a very humbling experience because we think that we know our history, and that I began to try to research the life of totally anonymous people, people who didn't know how to read or write, or you know, the first person in that family who signed their name, it was in 1902, almost a century later. And it was all my luck also was that the house belonged to the same family from 1811 to 1974. So yes, I was lucky because just in front of us, our neighbor was the son-in-law of the last owner. And so he gave me a lot of pictures, and he has a memory. It's just an incredible memory. He was a shoemaker, and he's still very interested in what we've done with this house. He was quite happy that we had restored it. And so he gave me some clues, but most of the work I did was at the Archives Nationales. I didn't know at the time that I would become the head of the Archives Nationales, but they were very, very helpful. And so it's very difficult to not only to find the names and the ages of the kids and all of this. You always find that and the titles and everything. What you don't find is what were they doing all day. This was not a farm. These were people at the outside of a city. You know, it was very far at the time. Think of Cartierville and the center of Montreal. It was just. And they were people who were working, the tailleurs de pierre, they were
stone masons.
But the man himself was just what they call a journalier, so someone who just probably sold his abilities. He was probably carrying things and things like that, and he had all these kids. They were 5 kilometers from the nearest church. There was nothing. They had nothing. I was lucky enough to find his will. And so at the time when somebody died, they had this inventory of their possessions. It's just unbelievable. They had nothing, absolutely nothing. There was one bed in that house. So that it means that people were sleeping on la paille, on straw, on something like that. And you know, they had one pig, one horse that was worth more than the house because they had a mortgage on the horse. You didn't know that existed, a mortgage on a horse? Yes, but it does. And so I tried to figure what was going on in their head, and especially in the life of the women who were at home. I never found it, really. It was an exercise, and it was frustrating in a way, but also fascinating.
I'm going to try to make a link back to the bibliothèque itself, because in this lovely document that presents the bibliothèque, you have a presentation, and I wanted to ask you about, you say there that the library has an importance because it's a public space. But it's a place to escape as much as possible from market conditioning that is replacing old forms of censorship. Mm-hmm. And in a way, when I read La Fleuve as well, you say at the end that maybe the role of archives and of interest in our stories is not only a commercial question, but a question of interest for all of us. Why is there a danger of censorship from market conditions?
Oh, there it's the writer speaking as much as the head of the library. I think any writer today will tell you that the market conditions are changing very much what we can read and what we have access to. It's plain and simple. If you publish a book today, if you write a book and it's published, 3 months after it's gone, it's finished. It has changed a lot. In the 19th century, you know that I'm I work on Georges Sand and on Balzac and on 19th century writers. And so when they would publish a book, people would talk about it for a year and sometimes two, and it would stay. Today, we're publishing a lot. I mean, I was just working this morning on the statistics. We just published the last statistics of L'Édition au Québec, so publishing in Quebec, that's one of our roles as a national library. And we publish in Quebec 800 titles for the youth a year, 800 titles. And more than 500 novels and 350 books of poetry, titles of poetry a year in Quebec. So think of all that's coming from the United States, all that's coming from France, all that you have. So if you go into a bookstore, obviously they cannot keep up with that. Obviously they will try, most of them, with few exceptions, but there are exceptions, but nevertheless, most of them will sell only what sells, And after 3 months, it's gone. And it's gone except if you have it in pocketbook or, you know, and even then, you have only a fraction of, even in a large bookstore, you have only a fraction. So it's market oriented. It's disappearing. It's seasonal. When you meet people, you go to a Salon du Livre, and I will probably have that at the Salon du Livre this week. If you go to the Salon du Livre and you have all your books just like that, you have these books, people will and they are well-intentioned. They will come in front of you and say, what's the latest? Which book, you know, which one is the latest that you wrote? And I keep saying, well, the first one wasn't that bad, you know. And you know, it's sort of very, for a writer, it's something difficult. Because, or you will meet your friends, really good friends, and they will tell you, oh, you didn't publish anything this year. Why? You're forced to publish, you're supposed to publish a book a year? What's that? I mean, we're not selling ledgers here. We're not. I always tell people, or you will meet friends who will say, you know, I didn't read your last book. I say, you have 100 years to read it. I still read things that were published in the 19th century or in the 50s or in the 60s. And, you know, it's supposed to stay, and it's not. And the economy of the book today, that's exactly that. And so the only antidote to that is the public library and what we, you know, what we can teach people. You know, but the real, and where the books are, it's here. And it's the only place. And I do go a lot to, I do buy a lot of books from people who specialize in old books for the fun of it. It's a great pleasure. I buy everywhere and I go there all the time. But at the same time, they cannot keep up also with all this production. And it's pushing us. And it's really in the minds of the people, it has become true that the book is just like letters. There's a date, a preemptive date. After that, it's not good. And it's, people have sort of internalized this idea. They want to see the latest, and the media. And I come from there, you know, it's the same thing. If you have not reviewed the book after 6 months, you don't. It's not very often that people will come back and say, "Oh well, we forgot to review a book that's interesting, and we should come back at it." And so it's really ephemeral, and so we have to fight. It's resistance.
It's a
place of resistance.
I'm going to bring I'll bring up a story from a little anecdote from one of your novels. In this case, it's about the problems of some artists have no memory. They've made the profession of youth. Instead of confronting them, we pretend to understand them. And the examples given are in Germany, there's some young Germans obsessed with the Reich, and there's a reference to a Puerto Rican heroin addict who impressed New Yorkers with his graffiti, and I think he died quite young, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. But you're driven by ethics, by standards and values. What drives you to that? What makes you so driven by ethics, values, and standards, open access?
Well, it's what I think about education, basically. And it's I'll give you a very personal answer. I think that I've been very privileged. I was not born in a family of privilege. I was not born poor also, but very, as they said in our sociology courses, lower middle class. And with not many books at home, with a mother and father who believed that I should, you know, learn music and go to school. But that was about it. And especially in a region of in the Abitibi where there was nothing. There was nothing. Not a library. In fact, I shouldn't say that. There were sort of two, maybe 100 books at the at City Hall in Aranda, and they were in English. And so that's about it. There was nothing. And so you read what you could, and I went to school, and these were nuns, of course, and they preferred us to read stupidities rather than get to the real thing, because the stupidities were less dangerous for our minds. I mean, stupid things. I mean, you know what they were writing for teenagers at the time, how stupid they were. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, which,
remember, and there was a series called Brigitte was made in France. Oh, my God. This Brigitte, was she virtuous? I mean, she did everything right. She was so dull. We kept reading these things. But you, at some point, things changed a bit when I began to read excerpts in our school books about George Sand and some other writers. We just had some little excerpts, but I guessed that there was something there. And basically, as I was an avid reader, I would read stupid things because there were stupid things. And, you know, I can read anything. And, you know, I can read Parimacho, also. I can read anything. If I have nothing to read, I'm mad. And so I cannot wait 5 minutes without having something to read. So I read stupid things. But finally, when I began to read something interesting and meaningful, whatever that was, it was mainly novels. It was very important to me in my life. And I have the impression, and I'm quite sure, that everything important that happened to me, and I lived a very privileged life, and I'm not talking money here, I'm talking about happiness, about meaningful experiences. I'm thinking of simple, meeting people that are interesting, going to places that are interesting, reading things that are interesting. I've been so privileged that you have to give it back. You absolutely have to give it back. It's a sort of, it's very forceful. I've always said that this library is in a way, Natalie Petrovsky wrote that she's getting even with her childhood. Yes, and why not? why not? I think that this was not right. I mean, that if I had learned earlier what was meaningful and important, there are some errors, because I made some mistakes and some important ones in my life, just like everybody else, I guess. But probably I wouldn't have made them. I'm totally convinced that everything meaningful came to reading and the books and all of this. And so I hope that one day, a little kid, all this happiness came to me by accident in a way, because I was lucky enough when I was at the boarding school in Hull to go to a Carnegie Library in Ottawa, where some librarian told me, here are the interesting books, French-Canadian books, littérature canadienne-française, what's that? I never heard that there was a littérature canadienne-française. And that's when I began to read Marie-Claire Blais, Thériault, and all these people, and suddenly the Neliga. I remember reading poetry, and, you know, the sky opened, and it's been true since then. But it came late in life. Not that late. I was 17, but rather late. And so I hope that kids will learn that earlier, and it will not come to them by accident. And so we must have these institutions. We must work at it. And it's for me, this link between culture and education is so important. Just this morning in Le Devoir, there was an op-ed piece by the son of Georges-Émile Lapalme. If you find Le Devoir before you go home, and if you read French, and I guess most of you do, read that. Georges-Émile Lapalme was the first minister of culture. It was called Cultural Affairs at the time in Quebec, and his son is writing this beautiful piece in Le Devoir this morning, saying, my father always said that culture and education should be linked, and think of it if we should take the Ministry of Education and make it a cultural proposal. That's what he wanted. And it's not. Our schools should be cultural proposals. All the rest is is not important. In the end, if your school is a cultural proposal, you will find, you know, your vocational choices will come nevertheless. You will, you know, you will study this and that you must study to earn a living and all of that. But if it's at basic cultural proposal, you will have a life, a real life. And that's the problem today. And I'm very worried about universities and colleges and all of them who have abandoned, in a way, maybe it's too strong a word, but nevertheless, have abandoned their mission for the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. I was reading just last week a definition of liberal arts. I won't tell you where I saw that, but I was amazed that the redefinition of liberal arts studies today would be a school of leadership. Wow. You understand what that means? It's straight from a management school. And it has nothing to do, you know. Ooh, does a writer or a philosopher has to be a leader? What's that? I mean, you know, we want to find a utility to everything. We want to find a function to everything. And knowledge for the sake of knowledge, that's the recipe for happiness. And, you know, and because you can think by yourself, if something happens that's difficult or cruel, or difficult to at least in your head, you have something to resist the difficulties of life, to think, to find that everything is relative, that you're never as unhappy as you think you are, and you know things like that. And so for me, it's a driving force.
Jim just mentioned Basquiat, who was this person who was painting, doing graffitis mm-hmm. all over walls, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me something that I've learned just an hour and a half ago, that you are co-president of the Arts in the City.
Yes, Arts in the Cities. C'est les Arts et la Ville. It's an organization that was founded exactly 20 years ago, and it was founded by Phyllis Lambert. It was called Arts in the Cities because it was also Canadian. There was a French part in Quebec and an English part in English Canada. And finally, it fell apart in English Canada. I don't know why. Maybe it's too wide. I mean, it's difficult for them to get together. While in Quebec, it's easier for us. And so this organization has had 20 years. We celebrated the 20 years last week. And it's a very special organization because we're discussing culture in the cities. I thought it would be interesting to just give you an idea. So I really believe in the role of municipal governments and the cities, the local involvement in arts and culture. It's more and more relevant to go at it by local authorities and local artists, and it's really making a difference in Quebec. So this organization is made of two parts. I'm co-chair because there's a chair on the part of arts and culture, and there's a chair that has to come from, that has to be an elected municipal officer. So the co-chair up to last week was the mayor of Sherbrooke, Mr. Perrault, and is now the mayor of Rimouski. And I've been the co-chair for 5 years. And we're working, we have 92 cultural organizations that are member and 361 cities, municipalities, I should say, because some of them are villages. And so we're trying to, again, it's my commitment to local cultural development, given my origins in that in the Rouyn-Noranda where there was nothing. And today there's a lot. It's really very lively in terms of culture. But that means that we have to work to do practical work. So we exchange information, we exchange best practices. We try to convince, the city councils. And they're more and more engaged in that. People in Montreal do ignore too much what's going on in the rest of Quebec. I would say that cultural policies, municipalities right now are writing cultural policies all over Quebec, and I would say that sometimes I have the impression that it's moving more, you know, this idea that culture is part of the city. It's more lively. I should beware. I don't know who is in the room, but it's more lively in some parts of Quebec than it is really in Montreal itself. That's my intimate conviction. Maybe because it's small, it's smaller collectivities, of course, and so we're really it's easier to get people to work together at it. And artists are now living all over Quebec. There are writers, artists who have chosen to go back or to go live outside of Quebec and Montreal, and they are contributing a lot to cultural policies in cities, in small places. And it's really very, very encouraging. We had more than 300 people in Laval last week coming from all over Quebec and discussing all this and learning. It's basically what we're doing is less debate and a lot of learning.
Thank you. It's our turn now.
Yes.
Ask Madame Bissonnette questions. I believe there's a microphone, a traveling microphone. If not, I don't see it, so perhaps
oh, well,
you, could just...
you know, we can understand quite well. This
yes,
auditorium was start. Built that we could use it without microphones.
So. If you just raise your hand and I'll try to recognize you. Here comes Heather.
Our philosophy of education at the Thomas More Institute is that learning should be an aesthetic experience, so we have lovely art all over our walls, so I hope you'll come and visit us one day. Dostoevsky said that beauty would save us, would save the world. Do you think if we could convince politicians that may be a viable alternative, that we'd have a better chance of saving or respecting the environment the way it should be?
Well, I think, first of all, just to your first part of your first observation, I've known the Thomas More Institute for a long time through the visual arts, and I knew less about what you were doing in adult education, but through exhibitions and activities there I knew. So I appreciate very much being with you tonight. But in terms of the environment, yes, I'm totally convinced that if people had a better aesthetic experience, they would value more, you know, the environment. I find this link so clear in my mind that I never understood why. People on our left, especially, you know, the leftists in our lives, and we all have leftists in our lives because we're progressive people, why they don't make this connection. I remember being at a forum at the UQAM a few years ago, where all the leftists in the world were there. I mean, it was very interesting. It was done by the Institut du Nouveau Monde, and they had people talking about the environment, the economy, the social issues. And so they had put me in a little box, which was called culture, you know. And I was lucky. It was at the end of the conference. So I took everything that they discussed, and I said, you know, the basis for all of this, if you want this to move, if you want your agenda to move, you know, in terms of social issues, you have to have first a cultural proposal. If you want people to understand what is, you know, justice and equality, they have to know something about history, and they have to know something about humankind. And that's cultural. Of course, you have to know something. And in terms of the environment, it's not only the aesthetics of it. It's really a cultural question. If we did to our cities what we did in the 60s and 70s and destroyed everything, you know, the entrances of our cities look, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, these highways that we put in the center of our cities, these commercial centers that were built right on the St. Lawrence River. I mean, with their back at the St. Lawrence River, you don't even see the signs. I mean, you just with everything that we authorized in our cities and our villages, we destroyed everything. And because we didn't have the culture to deal with that. And today, you know, this is an environmental issue, a very important one, the way we live. And so if you don't know anything about beauty, about aesthetics, about, you know, if you don't care, I mean, about the proportions of buildings, it's just architecture. And we still do that today. The kind of houses that we build, the kind of architecture that we authorize, even in this city, so it's all cultural. And if the people who work on, you know, environmentalists, if they understood better that's the way to go with the young people. If they want to convince them that it's an important issue, but it's they applauded. They thought, "Oh, very nice," and it was all gone a minute after.
Speaking of young people, Jim was talking about challenges. Some of our adult students, their children, tell them they won't read a book because they need information that's up to date, and they get it off of the net. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those?
Well, that's a great, great, great problem. You are absolutely right. I remember the very first meeting that I had as a new president, director general of this institution that was called Grande Bibliothèque du Québec at the time, because you know that we went through a couple of mergers. And so the first name of the institution was Grande Bibliothèque du Québec, and I went to see some people, and some of them librarians, but not all. And I began to discuss about the cultural aspect of a library. I made that simple proposal that a library was first and foremost a cultural proposal. And somebody told me, what do you do? Well, you can talk about culture, but we're mostly about information. And I was sort of struck because I thought that this was a cliche that I was saying. I mean, that this was a cultural proposal. And we have to fight that all the time. I must tell you that in libraries, this is really becoming a problem because of the technologies and because of this idea that information is first and foremost. For example, if you take the School of Librarians at the Université de Montréal, it's called École de Bibliothéconomie et de Sciences de l'Information. Well, in my mind, science, l'information is journalism. And it's very different. There's been a trend for the past 20 years to think that information is more important than anything else. That if you have the information, you can sail through life. That if you have information, you have power. You know how the saying goes. And it's not true, certainly. But they have succeeded in putting that in the head of young people. So we have, again, to resist that. And that's why I'm so upset at the fact that our schools are not cultural enough. And I think that we must beware. In the world of libraries today, what I see when I go to large conventions, you know, librarians and libraries, we meet once a year for 8 days in some special destination. I went to Oslo, Seoul, Durban this summer. Next, the year after that, it will be Quebec City. And we meet in some unlikely places and we discuss technologies for 8 days or almost, and, you know, all the new services that we can give, and not very often culture. And I think that culture has a tendency to go out of libraries as it went out of universities and colleges. So we must resist that. That's why this building is like it is. By the way, it's not just the architects who... We did plan it as a cultural institution. This auditorium was made for exactly what it's doing tonight, but also for poetry, for music, and the exhibition spaces. And we have a lot of exhibition spaces. And the kind of setting inside is calling you to a sort of a trip And, you know, it's not a place where everything is similar, so you're invited, in a way, when you come in, you're invited to walk around a little bit and discover. That's the idea of a cultural voyage. And so we try to embody this in the building. But I'm afraid that even in France right now, what I read from time to time from the books on the trade of libraries, we've been infatuated with all this information technology, yes, but what we're doing with information technology here is really a cultural proposal also, because we're digitizing our heritage at a fast pace, and it's very interesting.
Yes, I was just wondering, just reading recently in terms of the difficulty that you had with trying to get this funding for this library, you were thinking about it at the, sort of the end of the 20th century when we're and the internet being so explosive, and I know you're talking about culture, but what is important about having a building as being important in terms of promoting culture, where can it not be promoted through the net in some other way, or not necessarily have this size of a building? What was important about having a building?
Well, you know, it's a sense of place. I mean, the libraries today are becoming, and fast, the center of cities. And it's fascinating because they are not traditional libraries anymore, as you see when you come in a place like this. They're not traditional libraries anymore. They're not places where people come, take a book, and just go out. They're a place where they can stay for a few hours, discover, come to a conference. Everything is free, by the way, here, and we don't accept events that where people ask for an entrance fee. And everything is free. They have these exhibitions. They can, you know, meet with librarians. We'll help them for their personal research. This is a very different place. It's a community place. And even in small villages today, it's fast becoming the library. When they build one or when they enlarge one, when it's fast becoming the center of the place. It's a place where it's the new institution for the 21st century, as I say, inside a city. Let's take Montreal, for example. You know, it's the only place where people can go freely. Think of it. The only other place you can go without, you know, having to subscribe or something is a shopping center. You know, so it's a better proposal, and so this is the institution where you can pursue your own interests, you can learn, you can, and you can also just relax. And it has to do with the new lifestyle also. People in a place like Montreal, I would say that more than half of the population of this city is living alone. It's not because you have three kids and you're a single mother that you're not alone, as you know. And so people use this as a second home in a way. They come, they stay for a couple of hours, they come and they listen to a conference, they come. And it's all free and it's theirs. And it's fascinating because you don't have any other place that can do what we do. And do that without a fee, without nothing. It's public service at its best, in my view. And we've lost a sense of institutions in Quebec and everywhere in the world. It's not special to Quebec. We think that the public service has to do something for the economy or do something or pave a road or, you know, or things like that, but do something for the mind of people and do it freely. So it's a sense of place. First of all, that's why you need the building. And other than that, I would say very simply that you need a place also to do all of this. The internet is chaos. It's interesting, but it's pure chaos. And librarians, since the Library of Alexandria to this day, have been putting some order in the chaos. And who is going to organize all this? And especially, you know, in a place it could be true in Ontario and Quebec and Prince Edward Island, but you have to have someone who decides that for this collectivity, we're going to organize this material. And so all that we're doing in terms of, I was beginning to speak about digitizing, we're digitizing the whole heritage of Quebec in terms of documents, books, and periodicals. Everything that we can digitize, we will, and give it back to the people. And through the information technologies. But you have to have a place to do that. You don't do that in your basement by someone. You have to organize all this. And this is the new venue where you organize all this. And it's not the chaos of internet. You have to have places to be people, teams of people who are doing this. But basically, why is it that we have 10,000 people a day here? Not today, because there was the wild. We saw what a difference the subway can make. And it was so quiet today. Usually Tuesdays we have up to 12,000 people. And so why is it that they're coming in droves like that? And it's true everywhere you build a new library. And it stays. People said at the very beginning, oh, well, it's just curiosity. No, on some days here we have more people than we had on opening day in April 2005. So it's really growing, and it's true everywhere. Even if it's a very small library that you open in a village, or in a place where people didn't go to libraries, they just go. And so I really think that it makes a difference in the life of the people who come here, and we have now more than 300,000 people who have subscribed to this library.
Madame Bissonnette, I have a question for you. At McGill, it's also called the Department of Library and Information Studies, so it's both in English and French. I wonder, when we talk about commercialization, whether that in one way helped the libraries in one way. I'm just thinking that when Chapters and Indigo opened up, you had these wonderful couches where you could sit and read books, but now, of course, these wonderful soft couches are gone and hard chairs are put in. Whether, in actual fact, they made libraries realize that if you opened up the library for a place to sit, where you could have poetry readings, and you invite the people in the community not to look at a library as perhaps an elite organization, but something that everyone could be invited in your community to partake and make the library work, and also a place where you can buy those, you can get those books that perhaps are too expensive, whether that maybe changed the way that librarians started to look at library, maybe the directors started to look at libraries differently?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most librarians in North America would tell you that they were influenced by these kind of bookstores. No doubt about that. I think they had begun to rethink the library, but that gave them a shock, yes. That's what I was told all the time by librarians, especially because that all started in the United States. It's interesting to see the evolution of libraries, because it used to be that our models were Scandinavian, as you know. They still are the best, some of the best libraries in the world are in Scandinavian countries. But they were sort of traditional libraries, but with a tradition of service, incredible service, perfect service. But they served readers, nations of readers. If you go to Denmark or Norway, people read and read and read, and they have 90% of the people who are subscribed to a library, so they didn't have to think very much about what would make their life better in the library. They would go, and so they had the best libraries in the world. It's the Americans who really reinvented the library, and who have been so influential today, and all of them said that it was because of that. I think that today, if those couches have disappeared, it's probably because people sat there and read all day and didn't buy the book. So, but we tried, yes. But at the same time, I would say that in a place like this, we try to be across of European libraries and North American libraries also. You will have noticed that there's a café, a very good Café des Lettres Bistro that we just opened a few months ago when we finally found the money. Also, we the Americans will let you enter the library with the coffee. We won't. And I'm adamant that we won't. It's just because we want to keep this place. I want to keep something a bit sacred, nevertheless, about this place. I think I'm a bit worried about the American libraries. If they become too noisy, and we're still a bit noisy here because of the kids' space, so we have to live with that, but not too much. At some point, you're not a commercial place, and people have to understand that you have to keep it elegant, nice, and it's and quiet, and we don't want to have to clean it up after them, and we have to keep this space a bit different. When I always said that when people come in here to the Great Hall, it's a beautiful building. It's really perfect for readers, and they have to sense that it's not a proposal like any other. It's a different proposal, and they have to respect it that way. And it's working quite well. So that's why we're a little different, because Americans think that if they cannot go into some place without their coffee, you know, it's the end of the world. You get on an airplane and they get in with the luggage and the coffee. But I think we should be a little more cautious than that and be a little different.
I'm just wondering about when your inspiration to develop this library, when did it come? I grew up in Quebec, and there were no libraries when I was a kid. I lived in Cartierville, actually, and there was nothing around. I mean, we had books in our library in the school. This whole concept of this meeting place and having libraries where you could actually get books that were worthwhile reading, when did you realize that this was something that we needed here?
Well, you know, we were not the first ones. That's what I found so difficult at the very beginning, when everybody, you know, all my former friends in journalism were saying, we don't need that, we have the internet, and why should we have a library? What's going on here? And, you know, Mr. Bouchard's megalomania, and Lise Bissonnette also, and, you know, kind of silly things like that. They never saw a large library. I mean, there were quite a few projects in the States. There was a Vancouver library, a bit different from ours, but nevertheless, Toronto has had its own large library for a long, long time, the Toronto Reference Library. It's as large as this library, Vancouver also. And Seattle, San Francisco, Phoenix, all of... Even Nashville, for God's sake, I mean, has a large library, as large a library as this one, Nashville. And so, you know, it was about time that we realized that these were huge successes, and that we could have one in Montreal. So basically, yes, and I was influenced also by the Bibliothèque de France, though it's a very, very different proposal. Bibliothèque de France is a national library, period. It's the huge national library. But it was, nevertheless, when they moved the old national library to the new large, huge Bibliothèque de France, on the they were beginning to open it to a larger public. The British Library is now open to a large public, and the British Library was built about at the same time. So there was some movement in the world. But in Quebec, it was just like nobody noticed that, you know, there were these huge libraries. And some people were saying, well, we don't have the means to do that. Why? Why should we be different? Well, today I've forgotten about all that was said. I'm not sure that I've totally forgiven, though. So when I meet some of those journalists who tell me, oh, you know, it's beautiful, I said, why don't you write it, you know? And why don't you make amend? And but it wasn't so special. What we did, though, was when we were lucky enough to come after a few of these large libraries. In the States, there were about 10 or 12 projects already built that were quite interesting. So we went and we observed what they did. We went also to some Scandinavian countries. There was... in Malmo in Sweden, a very good one. We went to Iceland. We went to, of course, to France, where they were building a string of 12 regional libraries, quite large. Very interesting. You know, the French have this for architecture, they care. So they had all international competitions, and it was very, very interesting. So we went everywhere, and we took the best of all sorts of these proposals, and we tried to put this together and put our flavor in there. And we did consult a lot also with people around us. One of the first things that we did was to ask people who were living in this environment in Montreal to meet with us and to discuss the future of this library, what they expected from the library. And so all of this, we had a long time in planning. Somebody was saying that we fought for the money. Yes, we didn't have enough at the very beginning. It was obvious that we didn't have enough to build this building. The government had, you know, the prediction was about 75 million, which didn't make sense. So we had to fight to get it up to, in the end, it cost 97, and which is very cheap compared to. We had to wait for these millions for some time. So in the end, it was a good thing because we had lots of time to think. Lots of time to plan, and it's good to have to take some time for really planning. When the International Competition of Architecture, which was the first one in Quebec, came in with the finalists, we gave them 450 pages of program, maybe a little too much, but but still, it was very precise what we wanted. And they came with five different proposals. It was very interesting.
Yes, you have a question?
Subsidize this wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
Is this subsidized by the federal government?
The provincial, entirely the provincial government. The city of Montreal is paying $7 million towards this building, towards the operating budget of this building, not of the whole institution. The whole institution is paid for by the provincial government. It's $57 million a year, and the city of Montreal is contributing $7 million to this operating budget of this building. But we pay 4.5 in taxes, so that comes for them to $2.5 million a year that they get this wonderful building. So one must say that it's entirely subsidized by the provincial government. There's no federal funding here. It's a library, that's normal. Usually the federal government doesn't give money to libraries and to public libraries. And but that's why we insisted so much, and I did fight from the very first day to this day, for us to give services to people who live outside of Montreal. We invested $17 million in our technologies, and that's part of it is the reason. And now that we've been merged with the National Archives, that goes back just a little more than a year. We were merged with the National Archives in January 2006. And we have those centers, seven of them outside of Montreal and Quebec. And so I'm just coming back from a tour of all these places, and we are going to try to enlarge the services that they give to people there. And we insist on distant services a lot. So we invest as much as we can. It's that's the beauty of the new technologies. We can do a lot. Oh, it's paid staff. Almost, you know, volunteers. There's an association of friends of Bibliothèque et Archives Nationales, but right now it's paid staff. We have, all in all, in the whole of Quebec, 730 people. Here in this building, about 350. It's all paid staff.
If you want to ask a question, because I'm not sure if I can see everyone.
We've seen in Canada a lot of cultural development recently, and Toronto's stands out with a new opera house, recently, a symphony hall within the last 15 mm-hmm. years, a ballet house, extension to the museum, extension to the art gallery, the ballet school, the conservatory addition.
The Royal Ontario Museum also.
Yeah. Why aren't we seeing the same energy in Montreal?
Huge question.
I go to the McCord, it's very small. Mm-hmm. The Montreal Symphony plays in an inferior space. Mm-hmm. There's supposed to be a hall maybe in the next 10 years. You won. You got a great building. Mm-hmm. But what's wrong with Montreal?
Well, we won. I don't know why, you know, because you know that everybody was against it. You know, it was so hostile. I just prefer not to remember. That's good being from the Abitibi. The past is past. I think it's a huge question, and there are a lot of factors. One of them, I think, is this strange idea that we have in Quebec that institutions are not that important. It's really. I remember in the last was it electoral debate? No, it was the city election that we had the discussion. People are forever, and all my friends are artists, and so I don't want to speak against artists. But let's say artists' associations, for example, they have this idea that if you have money for the arts, it must go entirely to the artists. Okay, it's the to creation. That the city is all about creativity and not about its institution. I don't know if I can make that clear, but it's very important. If you follow the debate about cultural issues in Quebec, and especially, it's all about money. It's all about the money that is given to the Conseil des Arts du Québec, the Conseil des Arts et Lettres, so that it can be redistributed to artists. And governments are judged by the kind of money that they give to the Conseil des Arts du Québec. And I do agree they should give millions more to the Conseil des Arts et Lettres du Québec. But what I'm saying is that they are judged by the kind of money that they give and they redistribute to the artists. To writers, to visual artists, to whatever, in terms of loans and grants and things like that. And if you look at the debates, how the ministers are judged, it's always that criteria and nothing else. Almost, I shouldn't be that strong, but I think mostly that's the tendency. In terms of how do we value Montreal, you've heard time and again, I don't know if you follow the debate again, but in terms of what we value in Montreal, it's what we call the creativity. Remember when Culture Montréal committed, asked Richard Florida, of the famous Florida, about his study about the creative cities? Mm. They asked him to measure the kind of creativity that we have in Montreal. Well, he came back saying that we were very creative. We were, you know, we all find this very interesting. And it's for sure that if you are in the times of festivals in Montreal during the summer, it's more lively than Toronto. I go to Toronto from time to time. I think that Montreal is a bit more lively at night than Toronto is, though it has improved a lot over the past few years. There's this flavor to Montreal. Yes, it's a creative city. But once you've said that, if you don't have the institutions to support it, you will go nowhere. That's my conviction. And it's very difficult to get people to understand that. And so because people who get elected knowing that the criteria will be how much do you give to the creative part of the city. When there was the last municipal election, I remember a debate where Mr. Tremblay was there and Mr. Bergeron of the Parti Vert and my former Mayor Bouc. And mind you, they all said the same thing. It was Culture Montréal who organized the debate, and so we all went there at 7:30 in the morning and just to listen about their proposal for culture. All the three of them said the same thing. Oh, what a wonderful creative city. We dance in the streets. We have music. We have festivals. We have everything. And one of them, I won't tell you which one, said, "We're not into institutions." Straight like that. I couldn't believe. I mean, I was sitting just in the front seat. You know, we are an institution, and we and people, you know, sort of appreciate the institution in there. And so there's this idea, and I've even read when this whole thing about Toronto, when they got together and they got these huge budgets to create, to renovate or enlarge these institutions, a lot of people wrote in the newspapers in Montreal, even in the Gazette, saying that, you know, oh, Toronto, they put all their money into concrete, and they don't know how to be creative. Well, this doesn't make sense. It's true that Toronto could use a bit more creativity. They're a bit, you know, heavy from time to time on institutions, but Montreal could use more thinking about institutions. And it's, for me, it's very frustrating. I do agree entirely with you. There should be a forum in Montreal. I'm not even sure that the cultural summit that we will have this fall will deal in any way with institutions. I've not been invited to participate in that up to now. But if I were to be, I would insist on that. We have a deficit of institutions, of cultural institutions. I do agree entirely with you. And people are forever complaining about the budgets and the investment in institutions. But we, you know, the political will, it's not only the political will, it's the community. We should look at ourselves, the cultural community, the people who make culture in this city. Do we care about institutions? Do they care about institutions? I'm a bit worried. It's not all elected people who lack the political will to support institutions.
If there are no more questions, then or comments, I would just, on behalf of everyone here, thank you very much for the generous spirit that you've brought and given us. I feel inspired in the deepest sense of the word to be open to some of the things that you have given your life to. So I thank you very much for being here, and thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. Merci.
Thank you.
Bon.